we want to do a couple things at this first session, and that's give you a sense of the history of the word hospice, so that you understand that it does make some sense historically to refer to what we're talking about as hospice. This afternoon, you'll have a much clearer idea of what the most common understanding of hospice. It's a movement in the United States. And since breakfast, I've heard of a hospice in Minneapolis, and the doctor is here. There's a hospice starting in Bremerton, and the people are here. There's a hospice in Willamette, if you're from Salem. And this summer, a Lutheran pastor's wife who works there full-time was here. That will be more this afternoon, but the history of hospice, I think, is important to set the parameters. Joel, you're going to go first? Joel Oinas, village pastor, carpenter, volunteer, staff, and lecturer on hospitality.
My part of this presentation will be to talk about the biblical roots of hospitality. And I guess the first thing that needs to be said is that the theological root, or the one idea that is behind any concept of Holden Farm or a community, that root is hospitality. If you just think back on what the word means to you, I would imagine you have a pretty clear idea. The biblical meaning seems to be, it could be equivalent to neighbor love, or care and feeding and protection of the stranger. And the word stranger is really especially important there. The stranger over against your close friends. The obligation in hospitality was to see to the care and comfort of strangers. Okay, that is what I'll be talking about for about 5 or 10 minutes. And I'll make the point, the thesis statement first of all, is that the lifestyle of God's people is expressed most fully in hospitality, this care for the stranger. What we'll do is just take a quick sprint through the Old and New Testament, give you an idea of the practice. The word does not occur very often, hospitality, but the care for the stranger is so pervasive in both Old and New Testament that one might name the Bible the story of God's hospitality. Okay, Old Testament. The story of the people of the Old Testament could probably be called a story of a people who were both wanderers and landed people. They were both hosts and pilgrims. They were both sojourner and people at home in the land, the promised land. And the story is always a story of the kind of vulnerability one had as a sojourner and the obligations one has as a landed people. Remember the story of Abraham. Abraham was from the beginning a sojourner, one that depended upon hospitality from the people in the different lands he went to. He was a sojourner in Egypt. He's a sojourner in Canaan. And it was Melchizedek, a priest of El Shaddai, God Most High, that offered Abraham hospitality in his wanderings. There's an interesting story in Genesis 18 where Abraham, with his tent camped out at an oasis someplace, even offers hospitality to three strangers. The three strangers come and talk to him and Sarah about their having a child. Sarah laughs at the tent. Do you remember the story? Okay. There was a certain sacredness about the obligation to hospitality so that even a sojourner like Abraham would give that sort of hospitality to strangers that they meet on the trail. And of course, in that particular encounter, you recognize something that the Semitic people always recognized in hospitality, that hospitality was a sacred sort of encounter. That there was oftentimes the person that was offered hospitality in some way became the host and became a messenger of the grace of God somehow. And you know in the story of Abraham and the three men, there were the final message that, yes, you would have a child before the year was out. And Sarah laughed, and they did in fact have a child. The idea of sacred obligation is felt all through the Middle East. Going on in the story of the patriarchs, Jacob was a sojourner. Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, and took his 12 sons and his household because there was a famine, entered the state of vulnerability of a sojourner, went to Egypt and relied on Pharaoh's hospitality. And that is how the children of Israel found themselves in Egypt. Moses, the beginning of Exodus, to protect his people, does in an Egyptian taskmaster, and flees to Midian. In Midian, he is offered hospitality by Jethro and Jethro's daughters. There is another sacred sort of encounter, because it was while he's tending the sheep of Jethro in Midian that Moses sees the burning bush and has the encounter with God. Moses leads the people out into the wilderness, and that experience is probably the most important one in the history of the Old Testament people, that they left Egypt and they became wanderers. It's etched in their memory. The meaning of being a sojourner for 40 years in the wilderness, being vulnerable, powerless, hungry, and insecure, waiting daily for the bread that God would give them. And in their coming into the land, that memory was constantly brought to their attention. And they were, because of that sojourning, to become the hosts in the land. I want to read you just one representative part of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 24. These are words that Moses speaks just at the edge of the land of Canaan. It says, "When you reap your harvest in your field, now that you'll have a land, and you have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you do not go back to get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the stranger, the fatherless and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterward. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless and the widow. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore I command you to do this." The land was the source of their bounty. The land became the means by which one practiced hospitality, and the memory of their experience was the motive for the hospitality. The rest of the Old Testament is colored by the covenant commitment to care for the strangers, and it was the prophets who, many times themselves receiving hospitality, being alone and strangers in their own land, received hospitality at the hands of friendly Israelites. And it was part of the prophet's message that the nation had failed to practice the hospitality that it had pledged itself to. And then there are numerous stories, again, that show the practice of hospitality to be sacred encounters full of significance in God's saving acts. I'll just name a few of them. When Joshua sent spies into the land of Canaan, the one who practiced hospitality for them was Rahab the prostitute. She hid them, offered them protection, and it turned into a very significant encounter in the God's saving acts. Elijah lived with the poor widow of Zarephath and her son. The widow offered the hospitality, and in some way Elijah became the host as well as the guest, because the oil and the meal never ran out. Elisha had a similar experience. Then there's the story of Ruth and Boaz. Boaz offering the hospitality to Ruth, and that being significant because Ruth was the grandmother of King David in the story. If the Old Testament can be summed up as a story of people who were sojourners, received hospitality, and then took on the obligation to practice hospitality, the New Testament talk about the greatest hospitaller of all, Jesus, who spent most of his time practicing hospitality. Jesus was both host and guest. Sometimes it's difficult to tell whether he was invited or whether he convened the feast and practiced the hospitality. He ate with the rich and the poor, sinners and Pharisees. His parables often invoke the images of God as a host. You can think of the parable of the father and the prodigal son welcoming back the stranger who was dead, killing the fatted calf and having a feast. There's the parable of the king and the marriage feast, where the vulnerable, the poor, the weak, and the lame were forced to come to the banquet. And then there's the parable of the late night knock at the door to borrow a loaf, and even a grumpy, sleepy neighbor was able to practice hospitality by giving a loaf of bread. And the contrast was made between that person and the God who loves and practices hospitality. Jesus tells us in Luke 14 how to be a host and practice hospitality. He said to the man who had invited him, "When you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your kinsmen or your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you. It was a call to practice the love and care and feeding of the stranger. And of course, Paul tells the churches in his letters very bluntly to practice hospitality. And then there's the meal that we eat once a week here, which is our sacred encounter. This scene in Luke 24, when Jesus, the guest on the road to Emmaus, becomes also the host, and it becomes a sacred encounter for the two disciples. And then we eat the Lord's Supper. The supper that was initiated there was the supreme act of hospitality, giving one's life for people who are strangers and wrongheaded. In conclusion, the hospitality, the love of the stranger that we see in both Old and New Testament is the full expression of what it means to be God's people. And in many ways, it became an assumption of the church. And the first 1,000 years of the church's existence saw hospitality become a very central thing in church history and become institutionalized. And Cheryl will talk a little bit about that.
Thank you, Joel. The second brief presentation, and then we'll invite your discussion, is by Cheryl Clevin. Cheryl was part of the national staff of the American Lutheran Church, and now is a discovery prober. You'll have to ask later what that means. It is a part of the church. Jim Sifkus, who heads up Discovery Ministries, is here, and I had chance to talk with both Jim and Cheryl during the year, and they are willing and eager for part of her probe, and that would be into alternative possibilities for the aging, alternative possibilities for those who need medical help and need a sense of community, for much of the next year of her probe being helping us write the proposal. So she's here as the first gathering for that, and will keep in touch with us over the year. But she's going to give you some background on the word hospice, and I said at breakfast on St. Bernard dogs or whatever else.
And my foot just went to sleep. I've gotten a sense since I've been here and since we started talking about the word hospice that people have a strong personal investment in the issue. Whether it's because of someone that's died in our family, or whether it's because we're getting older and we feel like we're closer to the possibility of needing a hospice, whatever that issue is, I feel like there's something really strong going on. And we as a committee felt that it was important to get at the roots of the word hospice in order to not limit what we're talking about in terms of the hospice or the farm that we're talking about. I think it's easy to look into our minds or to have some ideas of what a word means in such a way that's going to limit us. I think we all have some ideas of what the word hospice means today. Either you know someone who works there, you work in a program yourself, or you've read it in the media, whatever it is. And I'm asking you at this time to just try to erase some of those ideas of what you have of hospice, so that we can have a clear, fresher look into the word. And as we incorporate the idea into the farm, it may or may not be what you once thought it was, or hopefully you're going to help us learn some new ways of looking at the concept of hospice. Like Joel was talking about, hospitality is a very important Christian word. We have roots back into our tradition, which makes us look at hospitality as an aspect, a very important aspect of hospice. And so when you look at the root word, hospice, which is H-O-S-P-E-S, the Latin word, it has a certain meaning. Which is a mutual, caring of people for one another. A very basic part of our Christian tradition. And when you look at the words that have developed out of that word hospice, I think many of you would know what some of them are. Hospitium, hostel. And in Paris, during the Middle Ages, hotel. Do you? What are some of the other words? Hospice, that we know it today. Hospital. Hotel, motel, host, hostess. You know, you can get into a whole aspect of words that have come from that original word. And as you look into the words, over history, which we want to talk a little bit about, we began to see a gradual shift in some of our value judgments of what the words mean. And one of the two words besides hospitality we're going to look at is hospice, hospitality, hospital. And looking at that value judgment that over history has started to develop, we can see how our relationship with one another, the mutual caring of people for one another, has often gradually changed throughout history. From the word hospice, which we're getting back to now, to the hospital that we have in our modern society. Hospice or hospice here often meant you could interchange any of these words, and it also had the meaning of guest and host. At one point in your life, you're a guest. Maybe in another point, you're a host. And it meant kind of a gradual shifting. And, you know, you could move back and forth in those relationships so that there was a much simpler mutual concern for people for one another. What I'd like to do is take the words hospital, and then the hospitality that Joel was talking about, and hospice, and together as a group, if we could just take each of these words and what images conjure up for you when you look at the word hospital? What was that? Sterile? Caring? Cold? And there was another one over here. Trained staffed or experts? What was that?
Money.
Honey?
Money.
Fear? Beds. Beds, illness. Isolation. I think of the word impersonal. Scheduled, dependent, we're dependent on hospitals. It's an institution. Medication, separation, a very important one. Images that come to our mind with the word hospital. Not wanting to undermine the importance of hospitals in our society in terms of curing being another word. We have an image of going to the hospital, of curing someone. And you look back into history and way back into the classical world, you can begin to see that there's some threads of what our modern hospital is about. You look into the Greek classical world. There they had what was similar to hospitals, places where you could go to heal, get healed. Large gymnasiums, treatment centers, spas. People would go there with these rich buildings, temples that were ornately built, and would go there to be healed, get massages, new diets, exercise, meditation. People would interpret your dreams. They had hypnotherapy, all those aspects of what a hospital was in the classical world. Unfortunately, only certain people could go there to be healed. If you were an incurable, you would be told to leave, and if you were about to die, you'd either die in the fields or on the side of the road. And so it was a very, in some ways, exclusive society. If you were born deformed, you were just brought to the mountains and left. Some aspect maybe of what the hospital maybe could be about today in terms of the dying. There's, if you haven't read this book, The Hospice Movement, it's a very good book to read. And the author suggests that there are some images from the classical world that can be brought in terms of what the dying were going through. And I'd like to read this. It was by a professor of medicine whose mother was in one of the hospitals, and this was his idea of what the hospital was about. What happened was a nightmare of depersonalized institutionalization, of rote management, presumably related to science and based on the team of approach of subdivision of work. Different nurses wandered in and out of my mother's room each hour, each shift, each day, calling for additional help over a two-way radio. They were trained as part of a team covering the floor rather than aiding a sick human being. Laboratory studies of blood and urine continued to be performed. Fluids were given. Oxygen was bubbled in. Antibiotics were administered. The days went by but seemed to be years. The patient was seen occasionally by large groups of physicians making rounds, presumably learning the art of practicing medicine properly. The chart was enlarged regularly with progress notes. These hastily scrawled writings always dealt with laboratory data, never about the feelings of the patient or her family. One report stated that the blood had been found in the stool. Someone responded by writing in the chart that in view of this finding, examination and enema were indicated. I suggested to the author that his condition reflexive act was not warranted in the care of an unconscious 80-year-old woman who wanted to die gracefully. You know, so we can see through history, starting with the classical world, and then in a few centuries later in Rome, there in their hospitals, the gladiator, the warriors, and which was the other one? The slaves were the people who were given to the hospital, who were taken care of. The rest of the people in the society were not really looked upon in the hospital. So you can see some ideas of the sterile, the caring, the cold, the trained, you know, that we're getting at in terms of why maybe some reason today that the hospice is beginning to arise. And we look into history. What about the word hospitality? What does that arise for you?
Fireplace.
A fireplace. Fireplace, food, fellowship, wealth, welcome, warmth, love, home, celebration, a pot of tea. I like that one. Or like an embracing act. And what we see when you look at those two words is that there's really been a division of what the word has meant. Almost like what's happening today in terms of the division that we experience between life and death. Life and death is something to be avoided, to be feared, as often as growing older is. What we want to do is to get back at some of the roots of hospice. In some of the reading that I was doing, we saw it going back almost 2,000 years. Christianity had a very important part in the development of the word hospice, starting in Jerusalem, Rome, Syria, where the governor, the emperor of Rome, was very threatened by the people. If you remember back in history, people being burned, Christians being burned, nailed to the Colosseum, for doing acts of love in a world that worshiped pagan gods. All of a sudden, these Christians started emerging, a political movement that said, no, we're not going to worship your gods. We're going to take care of the poor. We're going to take care of the dying. We're going to take care of the sick. We're going to take care of those who've been rejected by your society. And as that developed, the movement started developing, And some of the first history or the real written records that we have are during the Crusades. The poor brethren of St. John, or the Knights Hospitaller that they're called, that took place in Jerusalem, was starting to develop monastic communities. Within cloistered walls, were starting to take in people who'd been rejected by society, who were hurting, hungry, suffering people. During the times of the Crusades, they'd take them in, care for them. They were called journeyers, pilgrims, wayfarers. It was a place of rest, a place of hospitality, where people in every walk of society could come in together. And in fact, the knights, the princes, were right there suffering, dying, living with the common people in the society. Important part to look at. Often these monasteries tended to be by very dangerous parts of the world when people were going on to the Crusades. A river crossing or a mountain pass, places that were very dangerous in terms of walking on a pilgrimage. If you're dying, you're going through some very dangerous times. If you're going to the Crusades, you're still walking in some very dangerous areas. And it was important during the Crusades and during the medieval times that what started happening is when these people came together, if you had a disease or if you were sick, you were placed in one area of the monastery. If you were an incurable, if you were about to die and you knew that it was a hopeless situation, the people there knew it. For some reason, they were put together with the pilgrims going on the Crusades. What does that say about where the Christian community was at that point? The fact that the dying were on a pilgrimage, just as the pilgrims, the persons going to the Crusades, were still in that place. And so we see during the Crusades, the medieval times, as these monasteries kept developing, it started spreading into inns, hostels. The whole concept of hospice as an embracing act started taking place. And it's like history became like an accordion in some ways, where there were times where the political, emotional upheavals of society were really threatening, you know, the Christian idea. And so the Christian concept of hospice would kind of get squelched at times. They'd come in and take their wares. But the idea still kept spreading, regardless of how much or how big the hospices were at that time. And I think that's a very important thing to look at in terms of our concept of hospice today, the idea that we're all pilgrims, that we're journeyers. What else? The idea in some ways that a pilgrimage, or whether you're dying or whatever, is a very scary time, it's a very rugged time. It's a very dangerous time, and so you can be a sojourner among strangers, a pilgrim, and come in as a guest, or you can be a host, and in some ways it means the same thing. And that's what we look at. As later, when we get into the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, we start seeing again the beginnings of the modern concept of hospital, where the monasteries were kind of squelched, the idea of hospice was squelched, although it was still going there. And you get into the Industrial Revolution. You get into the idea again where no longer the people are taken care of in a hospice, but they're brought to workhouses. The Protestant work ethic started developing. People were urbanized. Our Protestant clergymen were saying that if you were sick or if you were dying, that was a sin. And I think that's an important thing to look at even today, because I think there's still threads of that. If you come down with a chronic disease of some kind, it's like, what did I do wrong? If I grow older, what did I do wrong? You know, I think that's still very much a part of us. And the concept of love that was going on throughout history all of a sudden became not so much love, but as an act of charity. Those who were privileged would act in a charitable fashion towards the lower people. And so throughout the day, if you could keep this image of journey, I think that's going to be important. The journey is to grow, to move, transforming what we see and hear in a new way, experiencing kind of the mystery. I think one of the important dimensions of the hospice throughout history was almost like time had a different kind of value. It was insignificant except as it served the needs of the people who were in the hospice program. That's why the monastic development of this. The dying is a journey, and it's a journey that we're all on. Can you see where the split? Oh, that we didn't even get into what hospice, the third word. What do you think of when you think of hospice today? Mother Teresa? That's interesting. Comfort? Family? Being deserted? Huh. A place of refuge? What was the last two? Dignity and compassion. Independence? How does that differ from where we are with hospital? Can you see the split again that we're working with? And I guess the importance of hospice that I see it today is that, you know, that it's responding to something in our history, something that's saying our needs aren't being met. You know, the mutual caring for one another may not be taking place in the hospital. That's why this alternative form of caring. Okay? Natural. Maybe we've gotten away from the idea that death is a natural process. Death in some ways being very similar to the birthing process. You know, birthing ourselves into a new being, a new reality. Opposite with the funding. Yeah, the person is involved in the treatment. We're a part of that dying process. We're not alienated from it. The family's there with you. The roles interplaying, so in a hospice you can be a guest and at the same time the host to the people who are caring for you and with you. We're talking about a very personal relationship with among people. Is that true for other people? In what way? We're talking about the issue of trust, if you can't hear. If there's going to be a giving-receiving relationship, trust is a very important aspect of that. Right? So it's the one thing we all have in common. It's like an equalizing force among all people. Okay, this afternoon, one thing that we're going to be focusing most of the time on is the medical model or what's happening in present-day concepts of hospices, beginning with England and going into the United States and the movement that's spreading. And so I think that would be the most appropriate time to address some of those questions. I'd like to see us stay with the idea of a guest house.
I realize that making some remarks relative to what has been put on the board, that the possibility exists that I could offend. Now, surely I don't mean to do that. That is not my intention. But with a lifetime spent in hospitals, medical institutions, I cannot help but have some ideas about some of the thoughts that have been expressed and perhaps have a little different point of view. Now, there is something in the first column here. There is something very, very seriously lacking. Responsibility. For goodness sake, Cheryl, put that word in the list.
Why didn't you bring it out?
I am bringing it out. I wanted to bring it out with some emphasis, John. Sometimes, again, one always has to have a contrary opinion or there's often no discussion. Sometimes I get the impression that responses like these can be programmed. I hope they are not, but I think that possibility often exists. We are trying to lead into something, and in doing so, one has to be very careful that in leading into it, you don't program responses. And I would suggest that here in some places, some of these responses have been programmed from this audience. So do keep those things in mind, and eventually, when one comes to hospice, one has to, despite all the generalities, and all these are fine things, there's no objection to these, there isn't anything new about it in medical problems and medical care. We just simply reinvent the wheel from time to time. But eventually you have to end up with an operational definition of hospice.
And that is that there was no question that people who have studied agriculture and teach agriculture, and I would say make this transference that deal with medicine on a scientific level, have been responsible. There's no question about scientific responsibility, but I think the response of people when asked to free associate here has been that there's been a little bit of lacking in human responsibility. That's maybe just the way that the medical world defines their area of expertise. And as I've understood it, has always been defined as primarily a scientific medical expertise. It may just be a question of trying to expand the understanding of the responsibility to people as rather than merely scientific, and we do that well, expensively, but well. It may be expanding our understanding of what it means to be responsible to human beings.
And not just leaving that to the experts who are doing a good job. I think you raised a good point.
I'm going to break it off, and I'm going to say that one of the nice things about today, and it's the only day in four summers, is that I can honestly tell you we have a continuing conversation today. We go to lunch. We have two movies on hospice at 3. We have a session on the more medical part, Marie and Leo and some people who have been to St. Christopher's. We have pet therapy at 7, and we have a forum tonight. This is the one day I can guarantee you. And we have, I hope, some people who will do what Dr. Andrews did this morning. We have some people who have run nursing homes who can say Holden has great ideas, but they're very naive. We have people who, I hope, will say, what you're envisioning on the farm, don't associate hospice because everybody's going to think of care of the dying, and you're talking more about a community of people that includes a couple people who are ill, but don't call it hospice or it'll be misleading. All of that is what we hope to get at today, and I thank you for helping us get off to a start.